Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest on the show today is Rhett Butler. Yes, Rhett Butler, founder of mongabay.com, an environmental science news web with a focus on tropical forests. Rhett is also co-founder of Tropical Conservation Science, an academic journal that aims to provide opportunities for scientists in developing countries to publish their research in their native languages. Rhett's writing has appeared in the Washington Monthly, Yale Environment 360, BBC News, the Jakarta Post, Conservation Letters, and Trends in Evolution and Ecology. Rhett has travelled widely in Africa, Asia Pacific, and Latin America, and has a background in economics. Rhett Butler joins me now from the San Francisco Bay Area, where he's currently based. Welcome, Rhett Butler.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I was initially attracted to you not just because of your work with forests, but because of your name. But anyway, we'll move on from that. Let's talk about how you first got involved with this whole issue, Rhett.
Well, when I was a child, I was fortunate enough to have opportunities to travel. My mother was a travel agent specializing in exotic travel, and my father had a lot of airline miles. So I had some pretty unique opportunities to see the world, or parts of the world, and a couple of places I've...
When you say younger, how old were you?
Starting probably 8 or 9, I would guess.
Oh, really?
So
right.
Young. And my family was always interested in wildlife, so we'd always end up, or we'd often end up in the tropics, often in rainforests. And there were a couple of places I visited, which after I returned home, I learned that they had been destroyed or greatly changed. And so that really impacted me personally. And around 1996, there was a particular incident in Borneo where an area of forest was logged after I visited. And I kind of thought about the animals there and what happened to them. And so I decided to write a book about tropical rainforests that would appeal to the general public to try and create.
Yes, what was the book called?
It was called A Place Out of Time.
And who published it?
Well, actually, it wasn't published, so that's part of the story. The book went through 3 rounds of peer review at an academic press, and it fared well through the reviews, but at the end of the day, the press didn't have enough funds to publish a kind of book that I was hoping to have published, which would be one with pictures. Yeah. Kind of defeated the purpose to just have a textbook. So instead, I decided to just kind of think about it for a while and decide what I wanted to do. At the same time, I was starting a career, you know, having a real job. And so after a few months, I kind of thought, well, I didn't write this book for money, so I decided to put it online for free for everyone to see, because that was really the objective.
Yeah.
And so that was the origin of the website.
And why is it called Monga Bay?
Well, Monga Bay is derived from an island off of Madagascar. The island is actually spelled differently and pronounced a little differently. But when I chose a name, I wanted to have something that was totally unique. So, back then, if you went on the web and typed in Monga Bay, there wouldn't be any search results. And so I wanted to be able to track people as they referred to the site.
And it's described to the audience where Madagascar is, Rhett Butler.
So Madagascar is that big island off the coast of Southeast Africa. So if you know where Mozambique is, which is just north of South Africa, there's a big island off the coast. And the island's about the size of California. I don't know if that's a good reference.
Yes, it is. Yes. And tell us who runs the island, what nationalities, what its history is, and tell us about its ecology.
Madagascar is quite an interesting place. It's been isolated for quite a long time, which means that a lot of the species are unique there. There's something like 80% of the species are found nowhere else on Earth.
Oh, really?
Madagascar is considered an ecological wonder. It has an incredible wealth of biodiversity, and it also has amazing cultural richness. You have the first people who colonized Madagascar actually came from Southeast Asia. They sailed all the way across the Indian Ocean, and then Africans came later. Mm. So it's a real mix of cultures on the island. That of course, in addition to lemurs and chameleons and all sorts of great wildlife, as well as unique plant species. So today, Madagascar is an independent country. It used to be a colony of France, and the economy is highly dependent on ecotourism. So there's a vested interest in preserving these wild places and the wildlife there.
How many species, not excluding plants, flora, how many species of fauna are there on the island?
I'm not sure if anyone knows the answer to that question. The number I saw a few years ago was 150,000 of the island's 200,000 species were endemic, meaning they're found nowhere else. But I'm not sure if that, I think that might have included plants. I'm pretty sure it included plants, actually.
Tell us about some of the most amazing species you've seen there.
Well, Madagascar is most famous for its lemurs, which are a type of primate that's somewhat like a monkey, but still fairly different. And what makes Madagascar, well, lemurs are only found in Madagascar. Some have ended up on a small island near Madagascar, and there are nearly 100 types of lemurs. But they've radiated into all sorts of different habitats and behaviors. So you have quite a diversity of lemurs. You have one that's called an Indri, which is about the size of a large house cat. It's colored like a panda bear, and it's sort of human-like in body form.
Mm.
But it's also the largest lemur, and it's famous for its song. Things kind of like a humpback whale.
Does it really?
It's pretty amazing. And then you have these other lemurs, which are called shifax, which are basically are also black and white, and they're well known for sort of dancing. It's kind of like a sashay in ballet.
Oh, really?
But at the same time, they make sounds that sound like someone cursing. So it's kind of like a cursing ballet dancer. So those are a lot of fun. And then, of course, you have the famous ring-tailed lemur, which is popular in zoos. And then you have little tiny mouse lemurs, which are among the smallest primates in the world. So again, there's a huge diversity. And then, of course, you have the reptiles. You have these amazing chameleons that come in all different colors and are capable, obviously, of rapid color change. And you have these brightly colored day geckos, and then these cryptic artists of camouflage, which are another type of gecko. So it's really an amazing place.
And, okay, so has there been any logging and destruction of the forests in Madagascar?
There has. Madagascar is somewhat famous for its large-scale destruction of forests, mostly due to subsistence activities. It's a very poor country, but there's been a very heavy impact on forest cover. It's not really clear how much has been destroyed, but right now less than 10% of the forest cover remains.
Oh, no, that means most species and animals would not be there.
Well, that's what's so remarkable, is that you have this incredible biodiversity despite large-scale forest loss. So
really?
It makes it all the more important to conserve what's left. Now, unfortunately, since the political troubles in Madagascar, back in March, there was a coup. A lot of the governance structure has kind of evaporated. So national parks aren't necessarily being manned, and people aren't really watching out for wildlife. And so what's happened in the northeast of the country, which is the most biodiverse part of the island, is you've had large-scale poaching of wildlife and logging. And it's been quite severe. And actually, yesterday, there was very bad news in terms of there are revelations that there's been the emergence of a commercial bushmeat market for lemurs. So basically, thousands of lemurs are being taken out of forests and sold to commercial markets in towns and cities. And then today there was information that came out about very significant logging in the most biodiverse part of Madagascar, this area that's an absolute biological jewel. So it's been really sad to hear about that. And you know, the one issue was with this coup, a lot of the aid that would have been coming in to support conservation is no longer coming in because governments have suspended support to the government.
So is there nothing the international community can do? Because this is an absolute jewel in the crown of species biodiversity in the whole world.
Well, resuming support for conservation activities would certainly make a big difference. So the first area that was affected by the illegal logging up a little bit north of where a lot of the activities are happening now, the situation was quite bad there, but there was a lot of media attention around it. So the government ended up sending in police to try and crack down on the illegal logging, and that's actually had a big impact. So the areas where you're seeing the logging now and the poaching are areas where there is no police presence. So,
and the government isn't interested since the coup in protecting the forests, right?
Well, Madagascar is a very poor country, so, you know, in many areas people can't even feed themselves. So there are a lot of issues that make demands on the country's resources. So that's one reason why aid is important. There is some corruption at the local level. Apparently, some of the logging has been apparently signed off by local officials. So there's some funny stuff going on in some areas. But in general, Madagascar's had a pretty good record in terms of conservation management. So these are relatively new problems.
Who's doing the logging?
It's actually criminal gangs that are often heavily armed, and they're backed by local traders who are often working with international syndicates. So there's a big Chinese presence, actually. And there, a lot of the timber, it's rosewood and some ebonies, are going. They're quite valuable hardwoods. They're being shipped straight to China.
Oh, my God.
So the real problem is you now have this foreign demand for these products. Lemurs aren't as far as I know, lemurs aren't being exported, but they're being sold in town.
And eaten. Well, the Chinese elite, this isn't a racist comment, I don't think, but they eat all sorts of animals, don't they?
Well, I think the issue with the Chinese is that there was a period of time where there was very little food, and so you kind of had to make do with what was available, and so they might have a wider palate than other cultures.
Yeah, that's a good explanation, Rhett Butler. Now, okay, illegal logging and criminal gangs. I live in Australia, where we can talk about that in a while, and the logging that goes on here. But to our immediate north in Indonesia and Papua New Guinea and Borneo and the like, there's been a lot of illegal logging, particularly under the reign of Suharto, that really wicked dictator who America supported and the CIA for years and years. Would you like to talk about what happened in Indonesia and Borneo during the Suharto years, Rhett Butler?
Suharto basically divvied up the country to his offspring. So you had these very powerful forestry companies that were run by relatives or friends of Suharto. And the destruction was quite severe in a lot of areas. If you look at Borneo, satellite pictures of Borneo, what once was, you know, majestic forest is now heavily degraded landscapes. It's often been replaced by plantations like oil palm plantations or forestry plantations. So there was this, as a way to sort of get control over the country, or in the process of getting control over the country, Suharto really handed out a lot of concessions to his close friends and relatives, and it had a very severe impact on the country's ecology.
And to whom was the timber sold at that time?
Well, the timber went all over. A lot of it ended up in the United States, as well as Europe. Today, a lot of it's going to China, which it goes to China, and then it's processed, and then it goes to the U.S. So the destination's the same, essentially, but there's an intermediary now.
And what's happening in Papua New Guinea? I just read an article, I think, that came from your website to say that there's an effort now to stop illegal logging in Papua New Guinea.
Well, yeah, so Papua New Guinea is heavily dependent on forestry, but there's this new idea that could basically provide alternative livelihoods for people instead of logging, so essentially earning money from keeping forests standing. And that idea is it's known as RED. It's called it's for reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. Kind of a bad name, but basically it means that developing countries, many countries, but it's going to start with developing countries, will basically be paid for keeping their forests standing.
And how does that work? Is it carbon credits and all of that sort of stuff from the developed countries who are pumping out CO2? Where exactly will the money come from?
Right. So the money will come from industrialized countries who are trying to offset some of their emissions. So
what does offset mean? I think we really need to explain this to the audience, Rhett.
Well, so offsetting means that a company in a place like the United States or Australia could, say, a power producing company, maybe one that runs off coal, could essentially cancel out on paper their emissions by funding activities that reduce emissions somewhere else. So essentially, if a company's pumping out X number of tons of CO2 a year, they could continue to pump out that number of or that amount of emissions per year, but pay for protecting a certain area of forest that would basically sequester that same amount of CO2.
But you see, that seems inane to me, because the forests are there anyway, and they've been there forever, although we're destroying them. So what you get is a forest that is supposed to be there, and a company that is supposed to stop producing CO2 because the global warming problem is now very urgent. And so one cancels out the other. What we should do is leave the forest intact and stop making CO2. I don't get this credit, carbon credit thing. Do you really?
Right. So, I mean, this is a big issue, obviously, with the
I think it's rhubarb.
But this is not a new issue.
No.
In terms of the forest carbon mechanism,
yeah.
It's been highly contentious. But they're going to be reducing deforestation, so they're going to have to be going to countries where deforestation is actively occurring. So the only way they can generate credits is by reducing deforestation that is actually occurring. So a place like Indonesia, which is losing anywhere between 2 and 3 million hectares a year, if they cut those emissions to zero, then they're going to get credit for. Really, they're going to get funding basically for reducing those emissions associated with that deforestation. So the emissions reductions are real, but that still doesn't get to the offsetting concept, which is quite controversial, for good reason. So a lot of environmentalists have very serious problems with the idea that that rich countries can get off, basically paying for cheap emissions reductions in other countries.
And they can still keep pumping out their CO2.
Exactly.
With equanimity.
Yes. But in the U.S., which obviously is no leader in this area, the way that the current Waxman-Markey bill, which is the U.S. climate bill, which is currently going to the Senate and will be voted on at some point soon, hopefully, So Waxman Markey calls for a roughly a 17% reduction in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. So, you know, people will say that that's not enough, you know, but that's, so let's just like look beyond that issue for right now. But if you factor in the avoided deforestation or RED, that reduction could actually increase to 27%. So the U.S. is committing to a 17% reduction, and the emissions reductions from forest conservation will be additional. So that'll be another 10%. So companies are going to have to cut emissions to some level, and you know 17% is a start. You know, obviously not what's needed, but it's a start. And these forest-related projects will be an additional emissions reduction.
Yeah.
So it's not a perfect offset. I mean, they're not. It's not. So this issue has been looked at, but again, there's definitely arguments that can be made that the whole offsetting concept is problematic.
Yes. Well, I'd say again, it's rhubarb as an ecologist and environmentalist. So I want to read from one of your papers here, Rhett, just exactly what tropical forests are worth in terms of global warming. Tropical forests store roughly 25% of the planet's terrestrial carbon, more than 300 billion tons. When forests are cut, their vegetation burnt and timber converted into wood products. Much of this carbon is released to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. The clearing of 50,000 square miles of tropical forests annually accounts for roughly 20% of global emissions from human activities, a share larger than all the world's planes, ships, cars, and trucks combined. In other words, despite the attention given to the fuel efficiency of cars and the number of flights taken by celebrities, parking all the world's jets and cars still would not offset the annual emissions from global deforestation. And then you go on just one more sentence, but reducing deforestation is no simple effort. Forests are being destroyed as a consequence of global economic forces. Demand for timber, pulpwood, for paper, beef, soybeans and palm oil, as well as subsistence farming. I think I'd like now to go on to the Amazon, because there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in Brazil, and the Amazon covers or includes many countries, including Peru, Brazil, Venezuela, and which other countries?
Let's see. So we have Colombia, Venezuela, Peru,
yeah.
Brazil, Guyana,
yeah,
French Guyana, Suriname, and
Venezuela.
Venezuela.
Yes. So, what percentage of the remaining tropical...
Oh, Ecuador.
Ecuador, that's right. What percentage of the remaining tropical rainforests is the Amazon combined?
Well, it's more than half the world.
More than half the world.
More.
And it controls a lot of the climate in that part of the world, and in fact, in that North and South America, doesn't it?
Right. So the Amazon plays a major role, not just in local climate, but also global climate.
Yeah.
So they've actually linked deforestation in the Amazon to rainfall in parts of Central America and North America.
Yeah.
So one could argue that if you're cutting down that forest, it's going to affect ranching in Texas.
So have you been to the Amazon, Rhett? I'm sure you have.
Yes, I've been to the Amazon many times. The last time was 4 months ago. I was in Brazil.
Okay, so I want to give you two little stories. One is about Papua New Guinea and then about the Amazon, just to sort of make it personal. We hear that in Papua New Guinea, you know, there are still many indigenous tribes living in the forest and from the forest. And what happens is that illegal logging companies from Indonesia and the like come in and they say to the tribal chief, look, we'll give you a motorboat if we can cut down your trees. And the tribal chief says, oh, all right, not understanding at all what that would mean to their lives. So the trees get decimated, rain comes, floods the area, erosion occurs, and there's nothing to live in and from. And then they get a motorboat, but they don't get any fuel to drive it. So that's one sort of classic example of what's happening, the wickedness around the world. The other one is, well, I went to the Amazon years ago, I think, 89. I wanted to see it before it went. And so I hired a dugout canoe up in Venezuela and went down with my 19-year-old son and three Portuguese-speaking fellows who spoke no English, who smoked a lot of dope. And we went down the Orinoco River for days and days. And it was just extraordinary that the perfume in the air was something like I'd never smelt before. The forest was so dense on either side of the river, it was impenetrable. At night, wild screams of all sorts of animals echoed through the forest. We set off at dawn each morning. We were in the prow of the ship hammocks. And the sky was rosy pink and the perfume. And then every afternoon, huge, huge cumulus clouds would gather overhead and there'd be a wild rainstorm. And then it would settle down. And then the Orinoco River then joined the Amazon at some point, and the river divided into the black part and the white part, and was about a mile wide at this point. It was extraordinary. And then we were dropped off at a certain little town. We had to walk a long way through a road that was being made to cut into the jungle. And we were almost knee-deep in mud for about a mile, being bitten by everything that you can imagine, insects. And then we saw areas that had been deforested, and the soil, although there's tremendous humus underneath the forest on the floor, like a sort of feather pillow, the soil is basically pretty sterile. So the ranchers come in and plant little spindly banana trees and the like, but it doesn't sustain itself for the next year and the year after that. So, Rhett, would you like to talk about what is actually happening to the Amazon? Who's in there destroying it? How is it happening? And what is the forest being used for, per se, in the land?
Sure. So in the 70s and 80s, deforestation in the Amazon was driven by big government projects, essentially colonization. So there was, in Brazil, there's a big push to redistribute the land, or at least give more land to these urban populations who had no land. So the government embarked on these big projects to build roads and essentially, you know, give out free land, actually even subsidized land where colonists were paid to go out there. There was also a national security element. Brazil is a little bit afraid that if the Amazon wasn't used, that it would, that the U.S. would come in, take it over, or other countries would invade. So back then, most of the deforestation was driven by, one could say, poverty. It was essentially government-sponsored land redistribution. But that's all changed in the 80s, or late 80s, 90s, and up until now. More and more deforestation is driven by enterprise activities. So cattle ranching accounts for 80% of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. So it's not so much direct logging. The land ends up being used for cattle. That's not to say the land isn't logged. So what usually happens is loggers will go in and take out the valuable hardwood, and then kind of the rest will be scrapped. They'll use bulldozers with chains and pull down the rest of the trees, and then they burn the land. And eventually it's planted with grass seed, and the cattle come in. And so this is really low productivity in terms of cattle.
Are these Brazilian ranches or the U.S. ranches? Who's doing it?
These are mostly Brazilian ranchers.
Because I remember when I wrote my book in 92, If You Love This Planet, a lot of the meat from those Amazon-type beef grown cattle the meat was going to hamburgers in America for Big Macs and the like. I think that doesn't happen now, does it?
No, I think that might have been mostly Central America. But right now, it's not. You can't export fresh beef from Brazil to the United States. It's just not allowed.
What about the leather?
No trade.
What about the leather?
Right. So there are other products.
Yeah.
So this is where things get interesting. But actually, getting back to why the land is being converted for cattle production, a lot of this is all about land speculation. So in order to establish a claim on land, you put cattle on it, and then eventually you could you could help to sell that land as the value increases.
Oh.
So in Brazil, the forest land has very, very low value. If you cut down those trees and plant it with grass seed, it might increase by 5 to 10 times. And so then you can sell the land for a profit. So a lot of this is being driven by ranchers, but also by
speculators,
kind of wealthy landowners
yep.
in the cities.
Yep.
But Brazil, I mean, that's not to say that Brazil has produced a lot of beef. Brazil is now the number one exporter of beef in the world. It has twice the number of cattle that the U.S. has, and the Amazon uh-huh. alone contains 80 million head of cattle.
Gee.
So these cattle are being, you know, slaughtered for beef and used for leather. Most of the beef is being shipped to Russia, Europe, Venezuela, you know, other countries. It's not going to the U.S., but the leather is going to China and other places and then turned into products that are then sold in the U.S. and Europe.
Like Nike shoes.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a nice transition to kind of a positive development that's happened in the last couple months. So environmentalists have long known that deforestation is a problem and that cattle ranching is, you know, the number one cause of deforestation. But they haven't been very effective at getting that message out or making effective change. So, you know, the forests just keep falling. People write reports and the forests just keep falling. And the Brazilian cattle industry has gotten stronger, more and more powerful. So what happened in June is Greenpeace took a little bit different approach. They linked some of these major brands directly to illegal deforestation in the Amazon.
Yep.
So we're talking Nike, Toyota, Adidas, Timberland, products that were sold in major supermarkets like Walmart. So this report came out and had an immediate impact, a rather incredible impact. Within days, the World Bank withdrew a $90 million loan to one of Brazil's...
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, one of Brazil's largest... cattle processors. The federal prosecutor's office in Brazil launched a billion-dollar lawsuit against the major cattle processors. Marfrig, which is the world's fourth largest beef trader, announced it would establish a moratorium on buying cattle from newly deforested areas. Walmart and some of Brazil's other largest supermarket chains also announced moratoriums. They said they would suspend contracts with suppliers found to be involved with illegal deforestation. Then we had Nike, Adidas, and Timberland announce that they were going to implement new forest policies to ensure that their products weren't coming from deforested areas. So this is incredible.
Mm.
And now what's happening is you have politicians and the major buyers of cattle products demanding some sort of system to ensure transparency or at least accountability, so there'd be supply chain tracking, so you can ensure that the consumers don't have to worry about products that were produced through deforestation.
That's just stunning that one report could have such ramifications. It just shows that there are ways we can get around these corporate entities who are helping to destroy parts of the world. But the Amazon is also used for other things, gold mining, right?
Right. So gold mining and logging are still big issues.
Mm.
Gold mining doesn't affect as large an area in terms of deforestation.
Yeah.
But it causes extensive pollution.
Mm. Cyanide.
It causes a lot of damage in rivers.
They use
cyanide and mercury.
Yeah.
If you fly one of these mines, it looks like a moonscape. It's absolutely total and utter destruction.
Dreadful. Well, okay, so then let's move on to the indigenous populations, those wonderful Indian tribes who've lived in the Amazon forever. And I see that although, you know, the government says these are indigenous areas of the forest, they don't own them. The indigenous people don't own them. And so what is happening to them and their culture and the way they live, Rhett Butler?
Well, it depends on the country in terms of ownership. In Brazil, indigenous groups actually control a significant proportion of the Amazon.
Yeah.
But they, as you mentioned, they don't actually own the land. So if oil or something is found on their land, then they don't have the rights to it necessarily, or even
that's
gold.
Just ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it does raise a lot of questions. You know, if they have the right to use the land, then if the government comes in and or, you know, auctions off the land for other use.
It's their land, you know, they have to have it to live. How can gold be more important or oil? I mean, it's just total exploitation, isn't it, of indigenous people, I think. And it's happening in Australia too.
Well, if you look at what's happening in Peru right now, it's especially distressing. About 70% of the Peruvian Amazon is has been allocated for oil and gas exploration.
Has it really?
And so what's happened, and the government is also actively working to make it easier. They're passing decrees to make it easier for foreign oil companies to move in and exploit those deposits. And that's actually a direct consequence of U.S. foreign policy. The reason they're passing these laws or these decrees is because the U.S., in order to get a free trade pact with the U.S., there are certain requirements for, you know, foreign investment.
That the U.S. can go in and do what it likes with impunity?
Well, the U.S. I'm not sure if with impunity, but so they can go in and, exploit these resources.
Yeah, with impunity.
The problem, I mean, well, there's many problems, obviously, but indigenous people, some of these claims, you know, conflict with indigenous groups. So the indigenous groups are rightfully quite angry.
Yes,
Couple months ago, there was a major uprising where more than 30,000 indigenous people and
local people
in the Amazon.
The Suri?
It was hundreds of tribes, actually.
All right.
Across Peru.
Yeah.
Blocked roads and, you know, restricted access to these areas that are going to be developed for oil and gas. So we had this standoff, and then the Peruvian government decided to call in the police, and in early June, there was bloodshed. Almost 36 people, possibly more, were killed.
Tribal people, yeah.
Well, actually, a bunch of police were killed.
They're using poisoned arrows, aren't they? I mean,
not in this case. Actually, it was supposed to be nonviolent. I mean, it had been nonviolent for a while, but then there was escalation, and then it's unclear as to exactly what happened, but the protesters were fired upon, and more than 200 were injured. More than 10 were killed, and then, you know, 2 dozen Peruvian police were killed as well.
So
I mean, it's a very ugly, ugly event, and Peru took a step back. The Peruvian government took a step back to try and reduce the conflict, and said, you know, we're going to revoke these laws. But, or they weren't laws, they were actually decrees. But nevertheless, a couple weeks ago, the energy minister came out and said that Peru expects to is going to go ahead with the auctions and expects to raise $1.5 billion in each of the next 2 years selling off more Amazon land.
Oh, my God. Eventually, you can see these tribal people are going to be destroyed.
Yeah, so the situation's a little bit better in Brazil.
Yes.
Where they have more established land rights. And so what you're seeing now is you're actually seeing indigenous groups be sort of champions of conservation, and people are looking at them as kind of the solution to reducing deforestation. And a couple tribes are now getting in with this whole carbon market concept, where they would receive payments for conserving, keeping their land forested. You know, they've done a great job keeping the trees standing, and so they it's now time to recognize them for that and help them provide financial support for them to create sustainable livelihoods.
I'm interviewing Rhett Butler, the founder of mongabay.com, an environmental science website with a focus on tropical forests. Rhett Butler, there's an initiative now by the Brazilian government too, which is absolutely quite stunning, isn't it, to raise $20 billion or something over the next 20 years to save the forest?
Yeah, so $20 billion over about the next 10 years to conserve the Amazon. Well, actually, the stated goal is to reduce emissions by 70%. Oh. And part of that is conserving the Amazon. There are a lot of details that still need to be worked out, and there's a lot of conflict over the proposal. And what's kind of interesting is that Brazil plans to raise that from foreign donors. Mm.
Which is all very fair because, the Amazon is a global treasure. And more than that is contributing to climatic conditions in that area of the world. And if it goes, the global warming is just going to be so aggravated, isn't it? And all the trees being burnt would mean that huge billions of tons of CO2 would be released, right?
So the Amazon stores over 100 billion tons of carbon, which is something like a dozen years of global emissions. So it's a substantial amount of carbon. But it also has other impacts. It would affect rainfall, and it would directly affect farmers in places like southern Brazil and Argentina, which are major it would affect rainfall in southern Brazil and Argentina, which is the major breadbasket for South America. One of the ideas is that one of the ways that they're looking to fund Amazon conservation is to try and put a value on that rainfall, saying how much is agriculture worth in southern South America, and also looking at hydroelectric dams. Something like 80% of Brazil's electricity is generated through hydropower. Mm. So if rainfall was diminished through deforestation, what would be the cost of Brazil in terms of power?
And the other thing is that as the forest dries out as a result of ongoing logging, then you get forest fires. Like there was a dreadful fire in the Amazon in the south 2005, right?
Yeah, so 2005 was a really bad year for the Amazon. You had this massive drought where these gigantic rivers were nothing but puddles. Communities were stranded. And then you had catastrophic forest fires that just raged across vast areas.
Has it recovered? Have the rivers recovered?
Well, yeah, so the rivers have now recovered.
Yeah.
But there was a period of about 2 years where it was an extremely severe drought. A lot of forest died and a lot of forest became susceptible to fire. So there was a huge pulse of emissions in 2005 from the Amazon.
It's kind of a feedback mechanism, isn't it? The more you chop down, the more the forests die, the more likelihood it is that they will be burnt. That adds more CO2, which produces more global warming. It's like the feedback in the human body, really. Let's talk about soybeans. Who's growing soybeans in the chopped down Amazon, and where do the soybeans go, Rhett Butler?
Well, so soy is actually an interesting case because the soy industry responded. Again, this is Greenpeace, but Greenpeace released a report in 2005 or 2006, which basically said that a lot of deforestation in parts of the Amazon could be attributed to soy.
Yep.
And not just direct deforestation, but also things like road building to support soy was driving, other types of deforestation.
Mm.
So Greenpeace released this report basically linking McDonald's to soy. And it was a little bit indirect. Basically, the chicken feed that was being used to feed the chickens that go into Chicken McNuggets was coming from Amazon deforestation, essentially.
Yeah.
So the Brazilian soy industry responded by establishing a moratorium that has actually been quite effective in reducing deforestation for soy. So that's actually kind of a happy story from an environmental standpoint in Brazil.
But the soybeans are also used, sent off to Europe to feed animals, aren't they?
Yeah, so a lot of that soy was going to Europe to feed for animal feed, including the chickens used in Chicken McNuggets, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was that direct consumer link, which Greenpeace kind of capitalized on, which was very important. And that actually leads to something. I mean, this is part of a bigger issue here. As I mentioned before, deforestation and actually many forms of environmental degradation were primarily driven by poverty 20, 30 years ago. But now that that's shifted towards basically corporate-driven deforestation, it's created new opportunities for conservation, or at least the effectiveness of activism. Because instead of targeting poor families who are just trying to put food on their table, you can now target these big multinational corporations that are sensitive to their images. So that's why things like the soy moratorium and the Greenpeace report on cattle ranching were so effective, because these corporations will respond. You're not taking food out of the mouths of starving children. You're going after these big corporations, who are looking to save a few cents on producing animal feed.
Well, then now let's just move quickly on. We're running out of time to palm oil plantations. I've been to Malaysia as a guest of the former Prime Minister, and coming in from the airport, all you see are these palms everywhere, and there's a huge amount of deforestation to plant these trees that produce palm oil, which is, what's it used for, Rhett Butler? What's palm oil used for?
So palm oil is used widely in foods. About 80% of palm oil goes into food production.
What sort of foods?
A lot of packaged foods or processed foods. So until this week, Cadbury in New Zealand was using palm oil instead of cocoa butter in their chocolate.
Oh, really?
It's quite controversial. And after a lot of complaints, they agreed to switch back to cocoa butter. But palm oil is also used in producing biodiesel. And as palm oil prices fall, they've come down quite a bit off their peak last year, it becomes more viable for biodiesel. And that's potentially a huge market, with the EU switching to various, trying to use more biofuel in their fuel consumption. But then you also have China, which is expecting to significantly increase biofuel consumption as car ownership increases. And companies are actually developing special catalytic converters to handle more biodiesel.
Oh, my God. Well, there are two questions. Does palm oil have cholesterol in it, saturated fat?
So palm oil doesn't have trans fat.
It
has other types of fat. So in the United States, there's been a big push to ban trans fat.
Yes.
And sort of an unexpected consequence of that is there's more, because palm oil doesn't have trans fat, you have palm oil ending up in more products, more food.
Where does cocoa butter come from?
Cocoa butter comes from the cacao. So it's a natural product you'd have in producing chocolate.
Oh, right.
So basically what Cadbury was doing is they were taking a product from palm trees and putting it in with what was produced from cacao, which is a little bit strange. You'd think they'd just use cacao for
must be cheaper. Right? So how much deforestation has occurred in the tropical countries to produce palm oil, Rhett Butler?
Well, there's been almost 10 million hectares more than 10 million hectares of oil palm established across Southeast Asia over the past 25 years or so, at least half of which has resulted in deforestation.
And it's ongoing, isn't it?
It's ongoing, and it's one of the primary drivers of deforestation in Indonesia today.
Yeah.
And so vast areas have been converted for oil palm.
And of course, not only do we get increased CO2 and global warming effects from deforestation, but we destroy huge numbers of species.
Right. So one of the big issues with oil palm is the crop, it's the tree that produces palm oil. Mm. But one of the big issues with oil palm is it consumes habitat for endangered species like the orangutan.
The orangutan, which is endangered, yeah. Isn't it dreadful? I just really associating now, Brett Butler, and you know so much about this. What's your prognosis for the future? What's your feeling about what is going to happen to these magnificent tropical rainforests?
Well, I'm actually somewhat optimistic. This whole idea of compensating countries for conserving forests is incredibly important. Because until now, forests haven't really had that much value. I mean, at least as living entities.
Right.
Basically, the best way to capitalize on the value of the forest is to chop it down for wood or convert it for cattle pasture or oil palm or, you know, other uses.
Yeah.
And so if you can place a value on living forests and the value is derived from the forest on an ongoing basis, so there's an incentive to keep it standing, it's going to have a huge impact. It's going to make conservation profitable in some way.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, in Australia, we've got temperate forests, and our eucalyptus trees actually store more carbon per ton than the tropical rainforest timber. And yet we've got a forestry department, especially in the state in which I live, New South Wales, which is just going hell for leather, chopping trees down, sending them to a Japanese chip mill. The trees, these beautiful, magnificent things, are chipped, sent to Japan to make very fine paper like Vogue paper, because it's short fiber paper. And then that eventually gets burnt, of course. And there is absolutely no way, it seems, for us to get through to the state government, which is mostly corrupt, like Tammany Hall, or to the federal government, which really takes no stand on it. So I, as an Australian, feel quite impotent and not knowing which way to turn. Rather, you know, I could lie in front of a logging truck, I suppose, but, you know, would that stop logging? Probably not. I don't know where to turn. Do you have any ideas, Rhett?
Well, people are lying in front of logging trucks in Tasmania down there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the forestry sector in Australia is pretty pretty intense on logging your forests. And if you look at the amount of carbon stored in forests, the all-time champion of the world is actually the eucalyptus forest in Victoria.
Oh, I know.
Talking a lot of carbon.
Beautiful, beautiful
trees. A study came out earlier this year. Yeah, it was incredible.
Well, I have to say, go on, sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, so in terms of solutions, getting back to this forest carbon thing, which, of course, is controversial, but a company in Tasmania actually just announced the first forest carbon deal there. Basically, they're going to pay landowners who have the right to cut down the forest on their land. It's their legal right. Not necessarily it's an environmental right, but it's their legal right. Instead of cutting down those trees, they're going to get paid for the carbon that's stored in those forests. So they're trying to create incentive to keep those forests.
And down. Where's that money coming from?
Well, unfortunately, that money is going to be coming from the carbon market. So it gets into this whole offsetting issue.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, just as an Australian and watching these huge logging trucks, it's like watching trucks full of dead human beings, really, because a tree's a living thing and houses so many other species of magnificent parrots and birds and koalas, you name it. I just think it's criminal. I think it's wicked, especially in the light of the IPCC report on global warming and the like, and that, you know, one of the ways to offset global warming is to maintain the forests and grow more. So, yeah, I don't quite know where to go in this country. I know where to go in some countries, but not my own.
So the other reason, I guess, that I'm somewhat optimistic, besides this whole idea of payments for ecosystem services, so it's not just carbon. You're also looking at water and other things.
But oh, yeah.
Right now, the most tangible asset in forests is carbon.
Yeah.
But the next big thing is going to be water, and then they're trying to figure out biodiversity, what's that worth.
Yeah.
So it's pretty complex, but there are a lot of really smart people working on these issues.
Yeah.
But the other reason I am somewhat optimistic is this whole idea of pressure on corporations. So if you could figure out a pressure point on these, on guns, is that the name of the company?
Yeah, Guns in Tasmania, another quite wicked company, I'd have to say. Yeah.
You could figure out some way to basically hit them where it counts, which is basically their, you know, people who are buying their product, which I guess is Japan.
Yeah.
You could really attack that part of the equation, then possibly you could get them to change their practices. That's where the environmental groups come in, or activist groups.
I might have a little talk to Greenpeace, because you actually can embarrass the Japanese sometimes by various methods, although not on whaling at the moment. Well, look, we've run out of time, Rhett Butler. I'm very grateful for this interview. It's fascinating, but more important, it's life-preserving if we can do the right thing with the forests, which are an integral part of trying to reverse global warming. I always say that trees are the lungs of the earth. They imbibe carbon dioxide and turn it into wood and exhale oxygen, which we breathe, whereas our lungs inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. So they're incredibly precious things. And I hope everyone's listened to this program. And if you need to learn more, please do go to Rhett Butler's website at mongabay.com. And I thank you very much for this interview, Rhett Butler.
Well, thank you, Helen. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking today with Rhett Butler, founder of mongabay.com, an environmental science news web with a focus on tropical forests. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you really did take in what we were talking about. This is really the fate of the earth we're discussing, and things have to change. I would say, though, that in the United States, the whole of the East Coast was once blanketed in forest. And now if you go to the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State and fly over Washington State and Oregon, they're still chopping trees down like crazy to make tissues to blow your noses on, to make paper towels, to make serviettes. And so therefore, we've just got to stop using paper. Blow your nose on handkerchiefs, not trees, you know. Anyway, that's probably the subject of another whole broadcast paper. Thanks for listening. I've just got a new book that's coming out shortly called If You Love This Planet, same name as the program, and there's a whole section on deforestation, paper, tropical forests and the like, species extinction. Goodbye, and we'll talk again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.